I'd rather lose everything than marry her. There is an old saying in the Mountain Territories, stitched into the lining of every grandmother's coat, and whispered over cradles on cold nights. The thing you throw away is always the thing that holds you together. Sable Voss had heard it from her mother the winter before she died, pressed into her ear like a coin into a palm. She had not understood it then. She was 11, and the world still seemed to run on visible things, bread, firewood, the warm flank of a dog. She wrote it on the inside cover of a small notebook with a blue cloth binding, the only book she owned, and she carried it everywhere after that, because even words she didn't understand felt like company. She was 23 now, and the notebook was battered, its spine held together with a strip of copper wire she'd wound herself. She still didn't fully understand the saying, but she was beginning to. Chapter 1. The Arrangement. The letter arrived at the Voss cottage on a Tuesday, which was already a bad sign. The post never came to the lower quarter on Tuesdays. Sable read it standing in the doorway, with flour still on her hands from the bread she'd been making for old Corin next door. The language was formal and cold as iron left outdoors. By decree of the High Council of the Thornvale Pack Territories, and in accordance with the Treaty of Mossgate, the daughter of the late pack chronicler Edvard Voss is hereby summoned to Ashenvale Keep for consideration as a treaty bond bride to His Sovereign Majesty, Alpha King Caelan Drev. She read it twice. Then she looked at the flower on her hands. She had no wolf. Everyone in the lower quarter knew it. Everyone in every quarter knew it, really, because wolfless women were not common, and people remembered them the way they remembered strange weather. She had no wolf, no dowry, no family name that meant anything since her father's death had emptied it of consequence. She had the cottage, a garden, and a reputation for being useful in small, unglamorous ways, delivering bread, mending ledgers, helping the midwife on bad nights. The treaty required a bride from the Voss line. She was the only Voss left. She packed one bag. She brought the notebook. Chapter 2. Ashenvale, Keep the Keep, rose from the mountain the way a tooth rises from a jaw, inevitable, slightly threatening, magnificent in the way of things that exist without apology. Its stone was dark basalt, shot through with pale mineral seams that caught the afternoon light and held it briefly, like a thought almost remembered. Sable arrived by the council's cart, which deposited her at the servant's entrance, because the driver had misread his instructions, or chosen not to correct them. She didn't argue. She carried her own bag up three flights of cold stairs and was met at the top by a man of about 60, with silver hair combed so precisely it looked painted, wearing a black coat with a small enameled pin at the collar, a running stag, she noted, the keep's secondary crest. Miss Voss. His voice was the kind that had spent a long time being quiet in large rooms. I am Oswin Fell, senior household steward, His Majesty's butler, if you prefer the informal title.
I prefer honesty, Sable said, because she was nervous, and nervous made her direct. Where am I sleeping, and what does the king actually think about this arrangement?
Oswin looked at her for a long moment. Something behind his eyes shifted, too small to name. Your room is on the third corridor, east wing. As for His Majesty, he paused, and she would later understand that pause as the most telling thing he said all week. He expressed his position clearly this morning. She found out what that position was at dinner, which she was not invited to, but whose sounds carried through the old keep's ventilation with perfect indiscretion. I'd rather lose everything than marry her. The Alpha King's voice was low and level, the voice of a man who did not need volume to make ceilings feel lower. She was carrying a candle down the east corridor at the time. The flame did not waver. Neither did she, outwardly. But she stood still for three full seconds, and in those seconds, something settled in her chest. Not hurt, exactly. A decision. A closing of a door she'd left open without meaning to. She would not try to make him want her. She would simply be herself, take up the space she was offered, and leave when they released her. She had survived worse humiliations on less sleep.
She lit herself to bed and wrote nothing in the notebook. Some things didn't need recording. Chapter 3. The King's Contempt and the Butler's Quiet. She met Kaelin Drev the next morning in the most undignified way possible. She walked into the wrong room. She had been looking for the Keep's library, following Oswin's directions, and had turned left instead of right at the portrait gallery, and the door she opened was not the library. It was the King's private study, and the King was in it. He was standing at the window with his back to her, hands clasped behind him, looking at the mountain. He was tall in the way that felt deliberate, every line of him arranged for authority. Dark hair. A jaw that could have been drawn with a ruler. He turned at the sound of the door and looked at her the way people look at interruptions. Through, rather than at. "This is not the library," he said. "I'm aware of that now." She didn't retreat. Retreating always made things worse. "I apologize for the interruption. I'll find it myself." He looked at her then, actually looked, briefly, cataloging. Whatever he found was not interesting enough to hold him. He turned back to the window. "Ask Oswin for a map." She pulled the door shut quietly, walked down the corridor with a steady step, and found the library 6 doors further along. It was extraordinary. 3 stories of shelves and a painted ceiling and windows that let in light from 2 directions. She sat in it for 2 hours and felt the Keep's judgment of her dissolve slightly, replaced by the simple pleasure of being in a room full of books. Oswin found her there mid-morning, carrying a tea tray she hadn't asked for. "He isn't what the title sounds like," Oswin said, setting the tray on the table with the careful economy of someone who says things sideways. "Not that that excuses him. I didn't ask you to defend him. I'm not." He considered the middle distance. "I'm asking you not to make a judgment with only half the evidence. A habit I've watched ruin sharper people than His Majesty." She poured her own tea. "What's the other half of the evidence?" "He said that," Oswin told her carefully, "about losing everything, because the council is forcing his hand. He has said the same thing about every candidate they've sent. He believes arranged arrangements are degrading to both parties." A pause. "He is not wrong. He is simply clumsy about it." Sable thought about this. "He said it about her specifically. About me. He doesn't know me." "No," Oswin agreed. "He doesn't." Chapter 4. What the Lower Quarter Knows. On her second full day, Sable did what she always did when she was somewhere new and uncertain. She made herself useful. She wasn't doing it to impress anyone. It was simply that idle hands made her anxious, and the Keep had more small needs than its formal staff was attending to. She found a young kitchen maid struggling with the bread delivery schedule for the outer guard stations and reorganized it in 40 minutes using a method she'd developed in the lower quarter. She helped Oswin cross-reference a discrepancy in the household ledger that had been nagging him, apparently, for 3 weeks, a misfiled supplier invoice hiding in plain sight. She carried a basket of medicine to the elderly pack healer who lived in the East Tower and spent an hour listening to the woman's stories about the Keep in its earlier years, because the woman was lonely and listening cost nothing. None of this was performed. None of it was strategy. It was just who she was. Oswin saw all of it. He said nothing directly. But that evening she found a better candle on her bedside table, beeswax, not tallow, and a small pot of rosehip jam beside it, the good kind that came from the King's own garden stores. Kaelin saw none of it directly, but he heard about it, because a Keep is a living thing, and its people talk. He summoned her to the study on Thursday morning, not warmly, not harshly, simply formally, via Oswin. She came. She sat in the chair he indicated without waiting to be asked twice, and she folded her hands in her lap and waited. He looked at her with more attention than he'd used before. She returned the look evenly. He had gray eyes, she noted, the color of the mineral seams in the Keep's stone, pale against dark. "You reorganized the bread routes," he said. "They were inefficient. You found Oswin's ledger error. It was a small one." A silence. Then, You have no wolf. She didn't flinch.
I have no wolf.
Then what exactly are you offering this treaty? It was not a kind question, but there was something in his tone that wasn't contempt. It was closer to genuine bewilderment, she thought, the question of a man who genuinely could not see. So she answered it, honestly.
I don't know what I'm offering the treaty, she said. I know what I'm offering in general. Work, accuracy, care, the ability to sit in a room with difficult things and not run from them. Whether that maps to your treaty requirements is your assessment to make, not mine.
He was quiet for a long time. The council selected you, he said, because you are the last of the Voss line, and the Treaty of Mossgate requires a Voss signature. Your specific attributes were immaterial to them.
I know that.
Does that not bother you? She considered this honestly. Being chosen for something I can't control doesn't bother me. Being judged before I've done anything does. She paused, but I'm used to it. He looked at her again, and this time it was different. Longer, like a map being corrected. She left the study without resolution, but something had shifted, the way weather shifts before you can name it. She could feel it in the air of the corridor. Chapter 5. The Mossgate Feast and What Broke Open. The High Council arrived on Thursday evening for the Mossgate Feast, the formal ceremony at which the treaty bond would be verbally confirmed or dissolved. There were 7 councillors, all men, all older than Caelan by decades. They wore the treaty's colors, gray and copper, and they looked at Sable across the long table the way assessors look at property. She wore her only good dress, which was deep blue and plain, and she had pinned her dark hair simply. She had no jewelry except a small copper wire ring she'd made from the same spool she'd used to repair the notebook, and she wore it on her smallest finger. It wasn't meant to be ornamental. It just was. Counselor Hast spoke first, as he always apparently did. Miss Voss, we are frank people. The treaty requires a bond confirmation from His Majesty, and a Voss heir before the new moon. Given the circumstances, and here he looked at her the way people look at complications, the council was prepared to offer accommodations for your specific limitations. Sable set down her spoon. My limitations. The wolfless condition. We understand it's heritable. There would be conditions placed on any children of the bond, naturally. Assessments, protocols. The silence at the table was total. Even the candles seemed to hold their breath. And then Caelan Drev, who had said nothing, who had been sitting at the head of the table with his gray eyes fixed on the middle distance the way he always was, put down his own spoon with a sound like a gavel. No. Everyone looked at him. There will be no conditions on children. His voice was still quiet, still level, but it was the level of deep water, not shallow calm. There will be no assessments, no protocols, no architectural language built around the word limitations in reference to Miss Voss, or anyone descended from her.
That is final. Hast recovered himself. Your Majesty, the treaty requires...
I know what the treaty requires.
Caelan stood. I have read it 11 times. I know exactly what it requires and what it does not. It does not require us to treat a Voss heir as a defect.
He looked at the councillors the way the mountain looked at weather. If the council cannot confirm the bond on clean terms, we dissolve the treaty, and I answer to the resulting political consequences myself. The room breathed. Hast made several adjustments to his expression. The council will discuss revised terms. Sable was looking at Caelan. He had not looked at her during any of it. He was looking at the councillors with the steady precision of a man who has made a decision and is done revisiting it. But when the councillors began their murmured negotiation, and the table's attention shifted, he did look at her. Once. Briefly. His gray eyes holding something she could not yet read. She looked back. She did not thank him with her expression. She simply acknowledged him, equal to equal, which was the only way she knew to do anything. He gave the smallest nod she had ever seen. Later, walking back to her room in the East Wing, she thought about the saying from the notebook. The thing you throw away is always the thing that holds you together. She still wasn't sure she understood it, but she was getting closer. Chapter 6. The Night Before Friday. She couldn't sleep. This was not unusual. She rarely slept well in new places, and Ashenvale Keep was full of sounds. Wind through the basalt corridors, the creak of the old bones of the mountain, the very occasional sound of boots on stone that was probably the night guard, and might just possibly sometimes pass her door more than once. She lit the beeswax candle and opened the notebook to an empty page and sat with the pen for a while without writing anything. Outside, the mountain was dark and very clear. She could see stars through the east window, the same stars she saw from the cottage, just from a different angle. She heard the knock at exactly midnight. Not the guard's knock, a different rhythm. She pulled on her coat and opened the door. Kaelin Drev stood in the corridor in plain clothes, dark linen, no insignia, his hair slightly disordered for the first time she'd seen. He looked oddly mortal. He also looked as though he had been standing outside her door for at least a minute before knocking, which, she thought, said something important. "I owe you an apology," he said without preamble. "Several," she agreed. "But go on." Something flickered in his expression. Not offense, something closer to relief. "I said something you apparently heard?" "Wednesday evening. The ventilation in this keep is excellent." He accepted this the way she accepted difficult things, without theater. "What I said was said in reaction to the council, and to being managed, and to the institution of arrangements I've despised since I was 17, and first threatened with one. It was not said about you specifically, because I did not know you specifically. It was a blunt, badly timed, and genuinely cruel thing to say about a person you've never met." "It was," she agreed. "I am sorry for it." She looked at him standing in the corridor in his plain clothes, gray eyes holding the candle's light, and she thought, he is a person who finds honesty costly, but pays it anyway. That was a rare thing. That was, actually, worth something. "I accept your apology," she said, "for what it's worth, which is quite a lot. I believe you mean it." He was quiet for a moment. "I told Oswin yesterday morning that I would rather lose the throne than enter a bond built on the council's arithmetic. I meant that too." "I know. I believe that as well." "What I did not tell Oswin," he said, and his voice was not quiet now in the way of deep water. It was quiet in the way of something that has been held for a long time and is being set down with great care. "Is that by Tuesday evening, after I'd read Oswin's report on the bread routes and the ledger and the healer in the tower, and after our conversation in the study, I had begun to think about things differently." The candle between them held very still. "Differently how?" she said, and her voice was steady because she had made peace, she thought, with disappointment, and so she could hear this without bracing. "I don't want the bond because of the treaty," he said. "I want it because of the person. Those are different requests, and I understand if the second one comes too late, or is unwelcome, given the first one was not made." He paused. "I am asking you, Sable Voss, specifically. Not the Voss line. You." She looked at him for a long time. "The answer to the first one," she said slowly, "would have been obedience. The answer to the second one is a choice." "Yes. Then I need until morning." He nodded once and left. She went back to her candle and her notebook, and she sat with it all. The week, the corridor, the feast, the apology, the plain-clothed king who had paid an honest cost. She opened the notebook to the inside cover and read her mother's saying again by beeswax light. "The thing you throw away is always the thing that holds you together." She understood it now. Chapter 7. Friday. She found him at dawn in the library. He was standing at the window she liked best, the one that faced east, that got the first light, with a book open in his hands that he clearly wasn't reading. He heard her come in and turned, and there was something in his face that she recognized because she felt it herself sometimes in the morning. A night's worth of consequences arranged and accepted, whatever they turned out to be. She stopped a few feet away. "Yes," she said. He was very still for a moment. Then he crossed the distance between them and took both her hands in his, and she felt the warmth of it all the way up. Not magic, not the bond sense she'd heard wolves describe, but something thoroughly human, and therefore entirely trustworthy. His hands were larger than hers, and slightly cold from the window. "You should know," she said, because she was who she was, "that I won't be managed. Not by the council, not by protocol, and not by you. Though I don't think that will be a problem, actually." "It won't," he said. "And the wolfless thing is permanent. I have looked into it. It does not change. I know." His grip on her hands didn't shift by a fraction. "Sable, I'm not asking for a wolf. I'm asking for you. There is nothing about you that needs completing." She felt something unlock in her chest that she had not known was locked. He proposed properly, went to one knee on the library floor without any ceremony of let-up, which was somehow right, which was somehow exactly him. With a simple band of silver he'd apparently sourced from somewhere on the keep's premises in the middle of the night, because the stone set into it was rough and unpolished, a pale mineral seam from the keep's own basalt, and it fit her finger with the imprecision of something improvised and the rightness of something true. Oswin appeared in the library doorway approximately 4 minutes later, saw the scene, and turned immediately to leave, smoothing his expression into complete professional blankness that failed entirely to conceal the fact that he was deeply, privately, and completely pleased. "Oswin," Kaelin said without turning around. "Your Majesty. Summon the council for 9 o'clock. "Already done, sir. I took the liberty at 6. A precise pause. "I had certain expectations about Friday." Chapter 8. The Council and the Copper Wire. The council meeting lasted 37 minutes. Kaelin laid out the terms without decoration. The bond would proceed, and it would proceed on Sable Voss's terms, meaning no conditions, no assessments, no language in any treaty document that framed her nature as a deficit. In exchange, the Voss signature would be given freely, and the Mossgate agreement would hold. Counselor Hast began to speak twice and was not permitted to finish either time. Not through interruption, but through the simple physical fact of Kaelin's attention moving on before Hast's words had accumulated enough weight to require response. Sable sat at the council table beside Kaelin. She had not been asked to speak, but she had not been asked to be silent either, and when Counselor Dreve, the youngest of the seven, and the only one who had refrained from looking at her like a complicated inheritance, asked her directly whether she entered the bond of her own choosing, she met his eyes. "Completely," she said. Dreve nodded. He looked satisfied. She thought they might, in time, become something resembling allies. The bond signing took place at the table. The document was 3 pages. She read all 3 pages before signing, which caused a brief pause in the room's proceedings, and a very faint expression on Kaelin's face that she would later, in better light, identify as pride, when it was over and the counselors had filed out, Hast last, which said something about him. Oswin poured 3 glasses of the keep's ceremonial wine from the small cabinet behind the door and handed them round without being asked. Kaelin raised his glass toward Sable. Not a toast, exactly. More an acknowledgement, the kind between people who have looked at each other honestly and survived it. She raised hers back. Oswin raised his with the precise decorum of a man who had seen a great many things in this keep and was allowing himself to feel quietly triumphant about this one. Later, in her room, Sable unwound the copper wire from the notebook's spine and wound it instead around her left wrist, alongside the silver band with its rough pale stone. The notebook needed a new binding now. She'd buy it properly, she thought, when there was time. For now, she tied it with a piece of ribbon from the bottom of her bag and set it on the bedside table next to the beeswax candle stub. She picked it up again immediately, opened to the inside cover. "The thing you throw away is always the thing that holds you together," she finally, fully understood. The council had wanted to throw her away. Her wolfless nature, her lower quarter origins, her inconvenient refusal to perform gratitude for being selected like livestock. Kaelin had nearly thrown her away before he knew what she was. She herself had nearly thrown away the possibility of him, by making peace with disappointment too completely. by deciding too fast that care was something that cost more than it was worth. What they had each almost thrown away was what was now holding everything together. She closed the notebook. She pressed her thumb against the copper wire at her wrist. She slept soundly that night for the first time in Ashenvale Keep. Epilogue. 1 year later. The mountain was in full autumn color when the keep held its first Vostrev bond anniversary celebration, which was smaller than the council had wanted, and exactly the right size for everyone who mattered. Oswin had organized it, because Oswin organized everything, and because he had very strong feelings about the color of the tablecloths, and was not shy about acting on them. The great hall was laid in dark green and copper, lit by 100 beeswax candles, and the elder pack healer from the East Tower had made the journey down 4 flights of stairs for the first time in 2 years, which said something about what kind of evening it was. Sable stood near the window that faced the lower quarter of the mountain, where the lights of the settlement below flickered in the early dark, and she thought about the cottage. It was still there. She had kept it, against everyone's gentle, practical suggestion that she needn't. She visited it in the spring and autumn, brought bread to old Corin when she could, sat in the garden she'd grown through 3 difficult seasons with her own hands. Some things you don't throw away. Kaelin found her at the window. He always found her at windows. She had a habit of being near them. He came to stand beside her, close enough that his arm rested against hers, and for a moment they just looked out at the lights below together. "Hast is requesting an audience about the Eastern Territories," he said. "He can have 20 minutes and no more. He knows the answer already. He just wants to see if repetition changes it." He made a sound of agreement that was also, quietly, a sound of amusement, a sound she had worked to earn, and now heard regularly, which was one of the satisfactions she hadn't anticipated. She turned to look at him. The candlelight made his gray eyes warm in a way that daylight didn't, and he was wearing the plain dark coat he preferred over the ceremonial options, which she preferred too because it was more truly him. She looked down at her left wrist. The silver band was there, the rough, pale stone of the keep's own mountain catching the candle's light, and wound around her wrist above it, worn smooth now from a year of contact, was the length of copper wire. Kaelin saw her looking. He had asked about the wire once, early in the year, and she had shown him the notebook and the inside cover, and told him the saying, and he had read it twice with the careful attention he gave to things that mattered. He reached over now and touched the wire with one finger, lightly, still wearing it. Always. She covered his hand with hers. "It's the thing that holds." He understood what she meant. He understood most things she meant now, which was the intimate miracle of a year lived honestly beside a person. He turned his hand over and folded it around hers, and they stayed at the window while the anniversary celebration went on around them. Oswin directing the service with immaculate precision, the old healer laughing at something across the room, the mountain outside going dark and magnificent and entirely unimpressed with human ceremony. "The thing you throw away is always the thing that holds you together." Her mother had stitched it into a coat and whispered it over a cradle, and Sable had carried it in a battered blue notebook tied first with copper wire and then with ribbon, across a distance from a lower quarter cottage to a mountain keep, through a week of being misjudged, and a night of being seen and a Friday morning that changed everything. She pressed her thumb to the copper wire. She felt it hold,